philosophers in
space, 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 space.
What happened to your eyes?
Where am I going? You will need eyes to see.
Where are they?
I don't know, sir. They must have hyperjets on that thing.
And what do we got on this thing? A Cuisinart?
No, sir.
We'll find them, catch them.
I would like to ask a question.
What is it?
Will I dream?
Brains. Brain bugs? Frankly, I find the idea of a bug that thinks offensive.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 61. I'm Thomas, that's Aaron. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm great, Thomas. I heard that you like milkshake takes, so I brought you some milkshake takes for your milkshake takes.
Oh, great. My main take is that we're just not talking about it enough. That's the main problem. I can't get enough takes either way. I need more pro-milkshakers, more anti-milkshakers. I just need to hear more of the argument.
I've heard that arguing things out is the only way to solve these problems.
Let's settle this on the marketplace of infinitely repeated ideas that never ends.
The Mobius strip of ideas.
Yeah, the purgatory of ideas.
Yeah, pretty much.
Dang, I should have tweeted that. That's not a bad one. Okay, I'm glad I came up with that. I'll probably tweet it after this. All right, we are going to talk in the purgatory of ideas about, yes, kind of milkshaking, but not really. There's also so much to talk about, and I'm sure Aaron's going to bring us some good philosophy as always. Relative to our viewing this week, which was the Waldo moment from Black Mirror Series 2, I'll call it. Those British and
chip,
their
chip, cheerio.
And their lingo. Yeah. Because for us, a series is like the whole thing. Like Seinfeld is a series.
Right.
Or whatever, yeah. You know. But for them, it's like Black Mirror Series 1 and Series 2. And then that's just like a season, which, by the way, is like one episode. A series is like anywhere from 1 to 3.5 episodes for them.
However many they feel,
which
like,
is better. Yeah. It's honestly better, actually. I'm teasing it, but it's better. It's I mean, trying to pack in 24 episodes of something like they used to do. I mean, now I think there's a sort of a compromise where Good Place, you know, they're doing like 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. That's probably a good compromise, but
yeah.
Man, anyway. That aside, I'm surprised to go back and find that this Waldo moment episode is from 2013. I must have caught it a little later. I think I watched it maybe like 2015 or 16, so still a while ago, but I didn't know it dated even back further than that, which makes it all the more interesting for how much stuff it kind of predicted, you know? So I'm excited to talk about it. Any thoughts before we jump into the exposition zone?
Yeah, well, I just want to say, you know, I often joke about getting canceled on this show, but this may actually be the episode. So we'll see how it goes. I'm going to try to package my takes a little bit better than some other individuals have packaged their takes. But I will raise some concerns, hopefully, that will bed themselves in the minds of our listeners, and then they'll be angry and frustrated, and then they'll message about it, and it'll be fun. That's what we do in philosophy, right?
So are you saying you're going to get canceled, or the show is
going
to
get canceled? You can probably pick up another host.
I'll find another. Yeah,
that's fine.
I mean, and I'm sure, where am I going to find another philosopher with too much time and not, you know, like, no.
But I will start.
In need of some sort of employment. That's never
going to happen. I do want to start by getting canceled with my view, and I take this seriously, that I think this is my favorite Black Mirror episode. And I think
that is already,
it is deeply controversial. Most people actually hate this episode, and I don't understand
it's
why.
It's not even controversial. It's like to say, it's controversial to say like, oh, this is a good Black Mirror.
Oh, I think
episode.
It's one of the
to
best. Say, absolutely.
No, no. You're not following my insult of you. You're not following my insult of you. It's like, it's not controversial to say like, oh, Hitler is my favorite leader. Like that's just, no, you're just. It'd be controversial to be like, oh, well, actually, Theresa May was a fantastic prime minister. Like, that's a controversial take.
I mean, the
like,
Hitler thing used to be controversial for a while.
Yeah, you saying this is the best Black Mirror episode is not controversial. It's just insane.
I think people should rewatch it and honestly consider how perfect a job I think this, I mean, 100% perfect, but really strong a job this episode does of not just predicting the future, but really predicting how soul-crushingly depressing it would be. I think it's a great episode. Mm. The post-credits scene especially is some of the darkest, you know, 30 seconds of television I've ever seen.
Yeah, but it, for me, it kind of just missed a little bit because it's not quite, which, I mean, you know.
I can understand if you missed a little bit. It's
still got so much right.
What's weird to me are the people who are like, this is a terrible episode. I do not,
I can't
grasp that. Yeah, right?
I agree with you there. That's not right. All right, so we can agree on that.
Okay, good.
All right, so let's jump into the exposition zone.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
This episode, it's not, and honestly, if you haven't seen it, I wouldn't worry that much about spoilers. I mean, if you want to watch it, by all means, go watch it, but it's not really like, the spoilers, I would say, I don't know if you agree, mm-hmm. they don't really matter that much in this one.
No, it's not a story that can be spoiled, I don't think.
Yeah. Especially now that, I mean, the spoiler was all of the history since then.
Yeah, right. It all came true.
if anyone's listening and they went into a coma in 2014 and just woke up and someone plugged in some earbuds in their ear. Okay, if that's you, pause now. Go catch up on everything. Yep. For anyone else, I mean, life kind of spoiled this episode. So this is about it's kind of like this comedian who does this insult cartoon, you know, that it's a vulgar cartoon bear whose name is Waldo. And it's kind of like a little bit of an Ali G kind of thing, a Borat kind of thing where it does interviews and then tries to embarrass them. You know, they kind of trick them into thinking it's like a kid's show, but then it actually, you know, goes vulgar and that kind of thing. And what's important for the purposes of this discussion is that it starts evolving and getting involved in like actual election stuff. Like it gets to the point where the cartoon bear is starting to get like weirdly popular, you know, and get to the point where they decide they're going to actually run the bear for office. And the problem is, I mean, there's lots of problems, obviously, but part of it is, you know, like the guy who invented the character and voices the character starts having, you know, second thoughts about what a serious problem this could be, because if this fake bear pulls votes, you know, then they're doing is handing the election. They're kind of splitting the vote and then handing the election to the conservative front runner kind of thing. And there's this sort of a side plot with the inventor of the characters kind of sleeps with like the other top candidate, right?
Mm-hmm, right. The Democratic,
the kind of the liberal candidate.
Version candidate. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're using American terms for these political parties. I know it's not correct, but we're just transferring. Generically speaking, there's a, you know, quote unquote conservative candidate and a quote unquote liberal candidate. And then this bear. And the guy, the comic kind of wants to get out of it, but the sort of showrunner guy or producer type character really threatens him to make him stay and says like he'll just take the character. Like he thinks he owns Waldo, but he doesn't, you know, the comedian, he doesn't own Waldo. So the guy says if he leaves, then he'll continue doing the character. And so it's a little bit of an ethical dilemma there. But the kind of the important outcome is that Waldo does split the vote and easily allows the conservative to be reelected. And the ending that we should talk about that, why don't you talk about what happens in the credits and all that?
Yeah. So in the course of this campaign, I want to tweak one little correction there.
Sure.
The thing that's bad about Waldo is not necessarily splitting the vote, because this is in a safe conservative district. The reason that he feels guilty and that people are angry with him is that he's sort of demeaning and undermining the whole system and sort of, you know, making a mockery, gotcha. Taking the piss out of all of this. And so, yeah, so in the process of this, they get approached by this shady guy from America, quote unquote, they describe him as like this guy from America or Washington, I think, who like wants...
Probably doing a Doctor Strange type accent, I'm guessing. Right. Yeah. Hello, I am from America, and I just been observing what's going on.
I'd like to talk about your bear. yeah. So, and he basically wants to option Waldo as a front man for a variety of, you know, like covert CIA kind of. You get the impression that this is someone whose job it is to like overthrow third world leaders or overthrow leaders in developing countries. He thinks that Waldo will be the perfect front man for essentially, you know, like corporate fascism across the world. And so the post-credits scene is the creator of the bear, now homeless, is like kicked out of the spot where he was sleeping and is forced to like wander in front of a video of at this point Waldo in Japan or something like that. Like, he's gone sort of global as this tool for oppressing people, essentially. He throws something at Waldo. He throws a bottle at Waldo and then gets beat down by a couple of police officers. That's just the end of the story. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a beautiful ending, personally.
So it all came true, basically.
All of 100%. It is real. Everything about this is real. Yeah. This is actually a spoiler for real life. It's not that real life spoiled this episode. It's that this episode, we just didn't realize that it was a spoiler.
So if you're also stuck back in time and listening to this somehow,
right. Sorry.
Pause and then live the next 3 years. I don't know.
Or find a different timeline as soon as possible.
Yeah, that's true. Avert everything. Go and don't. What's the easiest way to stop Trump if you travel back in time? Subtopic thought experiment. Would it be possible?
Yeah.
As just a normal person, you travel back to 2012. Would you try to interrupt that White House correspondence dinner where they always say like, oh, he was so embarrassed and that's what made him run? Yeah. I don't really think that's it, but some people have that theory. I don't know. Or just good old fashioned, I don't know. I won't advocate violence, but you know what I mean.
Right.
All right. Let's talk Waldo. So what philosophy do you want to draw into this?
Well, it's interesting that you're just saying about how would you stop someone like Trump, because that is part of the conversation I want to have, is like, what makes Trump possible? And in the modern age, is something like Trump effectively inevitable? So there's a lot of threads I want to pull on here, but I think they all center around the idea of the entertainmentification of politics, especially, but really, you know, all of our social issues, that we as a society need all and get all of our information packaged through an entertainment kind of format. And that makes it very hard for us to, I think, take a lot of these issues seriously. And it makes space for people like Donald Trump to achieve what they have achieved effectively. So I said the thing up earlier about, you know, trying to frame these things better. I feel very mixed about the situation. I want to say that from the get-go. Like, I think that satire and the sending up of political figures and important sacred cows is, and has been for a long time, a fundamental tool for coping with fascists, for coping with conservative ideologues, and And the trade-off there, my concern is that in using those kind of tools, it sort of results in a slash and burn that takes with it other things that we think should be taken seriously, healthy forms of cultural history and structure that we don't want to satirize down to the ground. I guess that's my thesis statement. Is that, well, so I mean, let's start with talking about the milkshakes a little bit, right? Like,
oh, great. Can't wait for the milkshake talk. Here I thought we would, we're already into the milkshake talk. Okay. What does that have to do with the cartoon bear?
Well, I mean, besides the fact that it twice in this video, somebody throws stuff at an annoying, abusive individual who's trying to make a mockery of the system, essentially. So the difference between Waldo and Sargon is I don't know. What is the difference? But why I think it matters is because lots of people are arguing about the use of these kinds of methods. And it is a really important ethical question, I think, whether or not we ought to use these kinds of techniques to try to embarrass individuals like him and Farage. And again, I'm really torn on it. And I think you know, I think people are totally right that it does work in one sense, at least, that people like fascists tend to need to take themselves very seriously, and that when you embarrass them in these kinds of ways, you undercut their effectiveness as fascists pretty well. I mean, I think that has worked in a variety of scenarios. And I mean, UKIP lost wildly, right? So I'm not saying that this is the only reason, but at least I think we can argue, we have pretty good evidence that there wasn't a massive pushback against the milkshakes the way that some people wanted to suggest there would be, right? That like this would build up a sympathy vote for someone like Carl, right?
We got a lot of people, everybody's going to vote for him because they got a milkshake thrown.
Right. So I think that argument is bad. And conversely, I think at least two other arguments in this area are bad, and we should do away with them. One is this leads to violence, or this is, you know, as what Sam Harris said, right? Mock assassinations or something like that, right? That's a silly stance in a lot of ways. But I mean, it's not my main concern here either. I'm not worried that someone is going to go from throwing milkshakes to throwing bricks, despite I know that there are some individuals who think that we should be throwing bricks. I don't think that that's what we need to be worried about, because I think that kind of escalation is really going to come in response to separate kinds of violent behavior. I'm much more concerned about, again, this idea that it lowers the level of discourse and it rewires our understanding of these issues to make them things that we sort of dismiss as games, as sport, essentially.
I think there's two different conversations here. And I thought we were going to talk more about the, like you just said there, the reducing politics to entertainment or game or whatever. And I don't really see, personally, I don't really see the milkshake discussion as really related to that.
I guess I'm saying, I think it should be. Instead of it being about is this violence, I think it should be, does this method, even though it takes out Carl, also undermine our ability to discuss the severity of Brexit, for example?
Look, here's why I don't know if that makes sense. Okay. So this is a little, I mean, it's a little specific to the British elections. I've been trying to look into that. Obviously, being an American, I'm not going to have the insight that any average like British guests would have. But from what I'm seeing, Nigel Farage did really well. His party did incredibly well. And Carl and Tommy Robinson and the other, you know, Meacham, like they didn't do well. So I think the milkshaking makes no difference either way on votes. I really honestly don't.
Well,
I think it's, you know, because we saw somebody who got milkshaked did really well, and some other people didn't do well at all. They did horribly. I just think there's far more at play, especially when you're talking about people in parties that are pretty extremist in a lot of ways. I think people have made up their minds on them for the most part. I don't think a milkshake does anything. And I also don't think that there's any sense in the question. Like, I think there's no logic to the question, because talk about America now for a second. Almost all political violence has been from the right forever. You know, when Heather Heyer or whatever was killed with a car, you know, where was this conversation about how this is damaging to our political discourse? And it, like, obviously it's, and I think it's kind of useless in that you're not throwing a milkshake. I'm not throwing a milkshake. Nobody listening is throwing or not throwing a milkshake. Like, and the people who are not throwing milkshakes are mostly not doing so because of laziness more than a principle. You know, like, either way, nobody's in danger of changing their minds on this. Like, there might be a couple of people who are taking part in this behavior. And for me, what's so infuriating about this whole discussion, and I don't know if this part will tie into your philosophy, and apologies if it doesn't at all. What's frustrating to me is that it's a complete waste of time. We should be talking about the milkshake the same way as if we were having a political discussion. We're like, what are the top issues? Flint still doesn't have clean water. The climate is, the earth's being destroyed, climate change. There's massive corruption, all this stuff. And then someone pipes up and is like, hi, my friend Karen's boyfriend is she's just not that cool. Like, he's not abusive, but he's just not listening to her. Mm-hmm. And then you'd be like, okay, I don't care. Like, it should be that level of, this is not a conversation we should care about. Like, it's, if we got into the details, if I was Karen, you know, and her friend, her intimate friend, maybe I would have some advice for Karen in a non-political discussion. This is a nothing thing. This mm-hmm. is one thing. And what happens is people take it and blow up it's like civility is always used so that people in power can kind of stay in power. You know, like these appeals for civility, there's months of discussion on the stupid couple of milkshakes that were thrown and instead of discussion on more important issues all the time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to, I think, disagree with you twice and then agree with you once on everything you said there. I want to push back a little bit on the claim that Farage did well. If you look at all of the sort of anti-Brexit parties versus sort of the pro-Brexit position actually lost seats relative to where it was before. I'm not saying it didn't get blown out as much as one would have liked, but I do think it's a little bit more unclear if Farage was successful, whereas it's obviously clear that UKIP got crushed for a variety of reasons. I'm not saying that necessarily the milkshakes caused any of... I can't attribute specific votes to people getting milkshakes.
It's nothing to do with it. But it's more about Brexit.
Well,
it's more about Brexit and the disaster that's going on there than it is about the milkshakes.
I'm trying to make the case on both sides here. Here's my view, right? So you mentioned, you know, no one gets their mind changed by the milkshake situation, right? I agree with you. I don't think people get their mind changed by the milkshakes. I think the people who throw the milkshakes think what they're doing is bringing attention from people who weren't paying any attention to the story to it. Even if those people already have preset views, the hope is you bring, you know, the people who agree with you, you get more attention of theirs on this particular issue. So it gets on the news and that, you know, gets people talking about how terrible Carl is or something like that. So the hope is that it promotes discourse. Now, I also think you're right that it can then in turn be used to block discourse, that you get all of this pushback in the form of like, oh, isn't this uncivil? And that you also get a view from the other side. And like you know, you can push back on this in a second. But I mean, like a lot of people will argue, you know, if we're going to sort of use these kinds of tactics, then let's all use these tactics against everyone. And then it's a race to the bottom in terms of, you know, the trolls mm-hmm. kind of win in that sense. And then like people like Trump, who are in the best position when everyone has sunk to their level, can be the most successful in that kind of world. So, that's why I think that I really sit on the fence.
That's
on this
an
one.
Interesting point. Although I don't think that last part is true. And I think I can tie it back into the subject matter here a little mm-hmm. bit, because I think what's interesting to talk about Waldo and the Waldo moment and that kind of thing is it actually relates back to the Rick and Morty episode that we love so much too, mm-hmm. where people are drawn to, you know, part of the Waldo vote is, you know, screw the system, that kind of thing, whatever. But Waldo also has a monologue that is kind of like an impromptu, you know, rant mm-hmm. that Waldo goes on about how like, oh, even though I I'm a cartoon character or whatever, but actually you politicians are even less authentic than me because you've been, you know, career politician, that kind of thing. That's a way of speaking. And we saw it also in the Rick and Morty, where we talked about, you know, using a certain language that's going to appeal to people in order to, and drawing in votes that way. But really, in the end, it's still just a tool for somebody else to, you know, take power. Mm-hmm. That they've just found a better way. It doesn't mean they're any more authentic. They've just found a better way to signal authenticity. And I think that Trump was effective in this way. So the last thing you said that I disagree with mm-hmm. was, as everybody starts, you know, devolving down to this level of discourse that, you know, it's that's when Trump's going to excel kind of thing. I actually think it's the opposite. I think Trump excelled because he brought a gun to a knife fight. I think Trump stood out so much because he was so unheard of mm-hmm. in politics, because it was so, nobody had any idea how to deal with it. I think that if you entered a world of Trump-like behavior where people just said stuff, you know, like whatever came to their mind, I think you'd actually flood the market a little bit, and Trump himself wouldn't, like, it might be something else that mm-hmm. thrives in that environment. I'm not actually sure. I'm not saying either way. I just think that what happened with Trump is it's so many factors. Mm-hmm. You know, by the way, the most overwhelming factor in Trump's general election victory was the Republican Party. You know, like mm-hmm. was being part of that machinery and a bunch of people, a bunch of infrastructure that was already in place. You know, that's the most overwhelming predictor was whether or not you were a Republican. You know, second then is like, are you a racist and all that stuff in terms of voting mm-hmm. for Trump? But we could talk about that in another discussion. So for me, it's this, what I find interesting about the Waldo moment is this idea that like there used to be a sense of decorum, you know, there used to be certain ways of speaking that, you know, and certain ways of speaking you wouldn't engage on the political stage, you know, like certain, I don't know if you call it civility, but certain, what's the word for it? You know, decorum yeah. kind of thing and a way of signaling that you're authentic in the case of Waldo is by just, you know, crapping all over all of that and just totally disregarding it and speaking more like an everyday person in quotes, you know, more vulgar, more no filter kind of thing. And I think it's an interesting point to ask ourselves whether or not that's a good idea, you know, like whether or not, you know, it might be inevitable either way. I'm not sure, but does it really, I think, what happens in the Waldo moment is taking advantage of that opening of a mm-hmm. of a breakthrough in that way of say, oh, he's the first to really talk in this way on the national stage. But that isn't the same as being authentic and having the right policies or any number of things that are important for a public office kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the Democratic primary constituents, right, how they are taking different tactics for trying to deal with the sort of post-Trump world. And same thing with Nancy Pelosi. It's been interesting to watch her sort of trying to do some of Trump's own game in terms of insulting him in backhanded ways and like playing off of his emotions some. And I'm worried. I don't know where that goes. And this is why, again, I'm totally on the fence about this. I don't think that we can easily just say, let's just never engage in any of this. It's like you were saying. I think you're very right to say that the flip side of, you know, the potential idea that if we're all down in the muck with Trump, then he's winning is if no one ever engages in this entertaining kind of politicking, you know, maybe we maintain the high ground, but we probably lose the election because, and this gets back to some of the philosophy as well, is this idea that television especially, but visual mediums have rewired us in such a way where we are more susceptible and more dependent on that particular kind of politicking. So, like, I mean, we're going to see what happens, right, with Elizabeth Warren and her I Have a Plan style campaign, whether it can genuinely break through this kind of infotainment style world that we live in.
But do we live in an like?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think this is something, and maybe we need to carry this over a little bit.
Maybe we need to define your terms a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, who is engaging in this infotainment? You know, is it pundits on TV or... are you saying, you know, elected officials now or people vying for elected office are having to engage in that or both?
I would say everyone. I would say including the citizenry. I think we're all trapped in an infotainment generating world at this point, and we're all participating in it in a variety of ways. And that's part of the issues with social media is that it allows us to all feel like we are engaged in something. What we're really engaged in doing is passing around these chunks of infotainment.
Infotainment.
Yeah. So like, you know, I mean, like, and this is, I want to say it's not just a right wing problem in this particular incarnation. I think like you could argue, and I love John Oliver, but you know, there are folks will argue that even the John Oliver kind of stuff, even when it does sort of talk about important things and bring attention to under-discussed issues, it doesn't do it in a way that brings about substantial change, and it does it in a way that reinforces this kind of bite-sized approach to these incredibly serious, incredibly big issues.
I just don't feel like there's a lot of substance to this point, you know, really? Like I maybe, yeah, because I, like, I'm trying to think in terms of how this actually works, you know, because where the rubber meets the road in this is who goes and votes and why they go and vote for whatever, whomever or whatever they're voting for, you know?
Well,
and so in this day and age, we're allowing people to be far more informed than they ever were, you know, before. I mean, but there also is a change of how much do people need to be. I think we've, you know, this is more of a political science and history point, but, you know, like back in the day, it might've been more that you were voting for somebody to represent you and to have more opinions that you would not even maybe even know about, you know, like, and a lot of this is, too, based on who has the time to do this kind of thing. You know, so there's a lot happening here. And I personally, I'm not convinced yet. And maybe you can, you know, if you want to make more arguments that John Oliver is causing any sort of problem by in an entertaining way, providing factual information to people. Now, if you want to say like someone, him or someone like him, if you want to say, oh, he's being deceitful, he's lying, he's whatever, that would be one thing. But like, if we're going to agree on the premise that he's providing pretty much factual information for the most, you know, reliable as anything else on TV information, are you arguing that even in the face of that, like even granting that,
yeah,
it's still harmful in some way?
How would that work? So I'm cribbing from what I was reading about this really good book, apparently. I want to pick this up over the summer, called Amusing Ourselves to Death. This is by Neil Postman.
I think I've heard of that. Yeah, I've heard of that.
Oh, book. Really?
I haven't read it. Yeah.
Oh, cool. It's it was written back in 85, and it was sort of not taken very seriously at the time, and is now considered fairly prescient by a variety of folks. And his argument is that especially with the transition to visual mediums like television, we sort of rewired our minds a little bit, such that we needed to be amused to take in information, or that information that was amusing would be the thing we would spend the majority of our attention on. So this then carries over, and the argument is, you know, even well-meaning individuals like John Oliver, who are trying to amuse us while also informing us, are also reinforcing that behavioral pattern, and that ultimately that behavioral pattern makes it harder to put aside the amusing stuff and have a lengthy, serious conversation about a lot of these issues. And like you were saying, people don't have time for lengthy, serious conversations a lot of the time. So it ends up with, you know, most Americans getting a lot of their information in these infotainment kind of formats and never having deep analysis. So you were saying, well, we're more informed than ever. In some senses, yes. In other senses, potentially not. That like we have more data, but it's filtered, it's prepackaged for us in a variety of ways that make it harder for us to distinguish what's true from what is the packaging.
I just don't know. I mean, I think it's when was a time when this was working better?
Well, okay.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And like, what was happening, for example? You know, like, give me, if you could outline that.
I got nothing on the answer to that question. I mean, like, and this is, I think, some people have criticized Postman a little bit for, you know, like, over-glorifying the print era as being better for human knowledge or something like that, right? You can look at muckraking and things. And I think it's an interesting sort of philosophy of mind question, though, about, like, does the, even if people were, you know, misinforming people with words before there was a lot of visual information, it could still be true that the visual format makes it easier to misinform, makes it easier to shift to a less informed discourse through no goal of anyone in particular, that it's just the nature of these different mediums and how our mind takes them in. So, for example, you know, one article that I was reading was pointing out that, like, there may be a difference in your mind between hearing the name Vladimir Putin in a time when you don't know what he looks like and don't know very much about Russian politics and getting information about Putin in a video while you're watching him, you know, riding shirtless or something like that, that like that constructs in your mind a very different idea than just hearing his name, and that those sort of complex packaged ideas may mean that a lot of information is slipping in to our assumptions without being sort of thoroughly vetted first. Right. If I were to write something out, it's a little easier for you to see, oh, here are all the ideas that are, being included in that particular written claim. Whereas if I show you a visual image, I might pack it with a bunch of, semi-subliminal kind of coding that seeps in.
So it sounds like you're saying there's more of an opportunity maybe for human biases to kick in when you see something. But I mean... This is one of those arguments, like, we might have been better off, without TV. You know, like, it's not going to happen. So what's the alternative? Is this actionable at all? I mean, there's just no possible way.
You come to a philosopher and ask me what's actionable? I don't provide actionable.
Well,
I provide
it just
problems.
Strikes me as, like, kind of, it just strikes me as kind of pointless. Well, like, there's, it'd be one thing to say, okay, the following things might be, maybe we can pull something in a better direction. But if the argument is visual media in itself, do you see what I mean? Like,
I don't think it's pointless even if we're not going to get rid of the visual medium, being aware of the way that it impacts us differently can change us and can impact our understanding of it some and might allow us to manipulate it in different ways. I don't think it's pointless to say a new technology has changed us. Oh, but we're never going to go back to the old technology. So who the hell cares? That doesn't make any sense to me. It's still important to understand how the new technology might have changed.
But we're talking about a book written in 1985, I think you said, and so if you're saying a new technology, like visual media is not a new technology.
And relatively speaking.
Like, but not in a way that we're past the point that you're talking, if you're talking about just any sort of visual media, we're so far beyond that. And so has this whole time, do you think we've been getting inaccurate information as a result of?
Yeah.
TV from the 80s and all that. Like, there's no.
Yeah, I think there's a good there's correlation no way you think between we can... the increasing disinformation, things like the rise of Fox News and these particular. And like, the internet's the same. The internet, even though people do more reading on the internet, they're also bombarded by visual mediums at every turn. Like, it's a commonly known tool that if you want to get more people to look at something, you have to add a picture and not just text. I do it for our content previews. Like, These things matter, and I think it's very important that we discuss.
But
I guess
the gap that I'm seeing here is I'm not seeing where they're yes, different could be, but I'm not seeing any proof or good evidence that worse is that, like, when you bring up Fox News, the problem with Fox News is that it's full of crap. Like, but it there's good visual media. You know, there have been people. And Fox News is, in my opinion, pretty much a cult. Speaking from experience on this, I mean, it borders on culthood. But I don't think you can indict visual media for that. Like, you could have before Fox News, or actually maybe around the same time as Fox News, and a little bit after it started, you had the viral email chain. Like, one of the worst parts of the Obama administration was these these chain emails that would go around and have just absurd text claims about Obama and how he was a Muslim and how he's all this stuff. That was huge. That was absolutely massive. I mean, we've had people misleading people en masse for centuries.
I think the issue here what I'm saying is like an either or absolutist kind of perspective. I'm not saying that you can't use those other mediums in those ways. I'm saying I think it's interesting to explore what the incentives are in different mediums, like how
for sure,
right? And that like the incentives can play a role, and that like Fox News, you're right, you had muckraking before you had Fox News, right? You had people ginning up fear of the other before you had visual images. But it's also very important to say visual images changed things, right? You talk about the Vietnam War, there's a lot of good evidence that suggests that the visual depictions of the war had a different impact on people than the previously right. written implication.
And right? that in that case, it was a good impact.
Yeah, I'm not saying that visual is always a bad thing. My point here is it could be a very dangerous double-edged sword where a lot of people are pretending that it's a one-edged sword. Right, like
maybe I sure, but just note that you started this off with John Oliver might be harmful, and I'm just trying to like with I think that needs some substantiation. Like you need to, if you're gonna make a claim like that, like what's the evidence for
well,
that?
I mean,
then you kind of retreated back to, well, it's changing. I'm just saying visual media is changing us. I don't know. I feel like you maybe.
Well, I would argue that he's playing a role in changing us, and that I'm not like, I love John Oliver. I watch John Oliver, but I put him out there as a liberal example of people who are using the entertainmentification of serious issues, and that like...
Okay, but I think I guess we're long on time, but I think maybe you've blended two things, which is infotainment and visual media.
I think because connected.
If we were just talking about
importantly
visual
connected.
Media, the first thing you would go to wouldn't be John Oliver. You know, like that's a specific.
I mean, I would.
Now, maybe it's a nexus of those two things. Well, he's not the most popular visual media show. You know, like
he builds giant show. Toys all the time. He like has giant visual prop comedy constantly. I mean, maybe
now
we need to dive into this further, but like, I do
of...
think there really is an important connection between visual medium and infotainment.
All right, well, we went a little long, but we can continue arguing mercilessly in the After Dark segment.
I'm going to hit you with a milkshake so hard.
Are you not entertained? We're both doing the gladiator thing. No, this is interesting. I just feel like there's a lot of claims being thrown around.
No,
here,
it's good. I like it when you push back. We don't always have to agree on this show, right? You were wrong about other things, and I was right about other things, sure. And it's fine. We can disagree.
You're wrong about this being the best Black Mirror episode. No, it's okay. No, we are way long. Why don't we give a little preview for next week, first off?
Yeah. So next week, we're going to do another fan favorite and another anime, because we haven't done one of those in a while. It's called One Punch Man. Mm-hmm. It's a fun one. We're just going to do the first episode, so it'll be super easy for everyone to get into. There's only like one season worth of it on Netflix right now. And it deals with issues of like power creep, which we've talked about before, and like hedonic treadmills and, achieving your goals. And sort of the question of like, is achieving your goals what you want, or is working towards achieving your goals what you really want? So I think it's got some good stuff in there.
Yeah, I love that question. That's awesome. And then we've got to do our new, brand new, thank our top patrons. And the new part is we're going to start with our $25 level and go up from there.
Yeah. So thanks to our 25 level patrons, Corey Ebert, Sarah Wheeler, Spoiler Deleted is my favorite Avenger, Dead Avenger. Spoiler Deleted is a close second. Frederico Fermi, Attorney at Law. Thomas and I just had some fun with the Fermi Paradox over on GAM. If you haven't seen that one, you should go check it out.
Oh, right. Yeah, definitely check out God Awful Movies with Aaron and I on it.
Yeah. And then, of course, as always, most important, thanks to our definitely pretty sure not a clone patrons, Philip Gatt, Philosophy Book Club Will Live Again. Cheers. Thomas Explains the Patreon Names is my new favorite segment. Oh, that's horrible. And Aaron is pro-cloning so he can cannibalize himself. True story. I have Aaron 2 growing in a vat right now. Marinating. I suppose marinating awesome. Is the right term in that context.
Well, you know, there's a growth period and a marination period. Right. You want to make sure it's, the flavor and all that. for the cannibalism purposes. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. And of course, go to patreon.com/0G. Check out our extended arguing over on the After Dark and more. Get a shout out. Hop on over to the $25 level. Hop on up, I guess I should say, and get that shout out. Make Aaron say something funny every week. It's a good time. I love it. Thank you guys so much. And we'll see you after dark or next week.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/0G, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
It's not all about me complaining about feminism and Thomas complaining about how nothing makes sense in the Marvel Universe. Sometimes we argue after dark.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.